Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, along with Pastor David Bortons of South Africa. And today we're going to do a show, a continuing saga of white genocide happening in South Africa. And we put the link in the chat room, www.whitenationnetwork.com, which details what actually happened in South Africa in 1994. And how white South Africans were lied to, deceived, and promised a much better world once black rule, majority rule, is established in South Africa. And first of all, this statement here by a person I'm not familiar with, Pastor Peter Mokaba, the first terrorist to chant, "Kill the Boer, kill the farmer." It, you know, this has been going on even before the 1994. And there was never any intention to live peaceably with whites, was there?
Good evening, Pastor Eli, and good evening to our listeners across the globe. Pastor, yes, there's a lot that can be said about this. Peter Mokaba himself was one of the boycott leaders in the 1975 wave of boycotts that swept across the whole of South Africa in terms of black schools, who stated that they did not want to be educated in Afrikaans. But that was just an excuse, because there was no enforcement of Afrikaans onto the students. In fact, they were educated in their mother tongue, and
by white people or by black teachers.
By white people, yes.
Interesting.
Pastor, it was a mix. It was a mix because, in many cases, the black teachers were substandard in terms of the national education policies, and where they could be used, they were used. But as also clearly visible today and evident today in South Africa, already after 24 years of so-called democracy, South African schooling system is of the worst in Africa because of the way in which they not just nepotism is rife.
Yes.
So people get appointed into positions of power, or into the lower echelons of the structures, and they are, for example, superintendents of whole districts of schools, or in control of schools, and they don't have an inkliest idea as to how a school even is run. So by nepotism and by favoritism, because of the way in which people gain votes for elections, they then have appointments of people who cannot do the work. And most of the times, those people's jobs are then done and allocated out to so-called agents, whom, of course, charge ridiculous prices. And in many cases, these agents are also nepotists or people who have been appointed because they are family members or related to the people in control. Now, coming back to 1975, I can recall I got married in 1975 the first time, and I relocated from Durban to Johannesburg in 1976. And 1976 and 77, I did my theological training, or my theological studies at a theology college in Auckland Park in Johannesburg.
Okay.
Now, from where we lived, I lived in Newlands at that time. From where we lived in a fairly high-rise flat on a hill, we could basically see right all the way down through Baragwanath onto and beyond Soweto. And daily you could see these pillars of smoke that arose from schools that were burning or being burnt by these students. Also, the governmental institutions like clinics, hospitals, and governmental offices or local government offices. So they waged a war against the very institutions of education and those institutions that were in fact in place to uplift themselves.
Yes.
Now, this is one of the traits that has and that could have, well, that was evident right from the beginning. They seemed to target those institutions that were devised to uplift their,
right,
their quality of life.
For black education,
people. Education, the entertainment, absolutely, absolutely, Pastor.
Mm-hmm.
But the strange thing is, nowhere in the whole of South Africa was there a larger concentration of Roman Catholic churches than in Soweto. And on one particular occasion, when I looked at a map of Soweto, now I'm talking about a street block where there are perhaps 100 of these dwellings that the government, the apartheid government, built for the blacks. They didn't live, or so many of them did not live in shelters like they do today. They lived in shacks that were erected by the government of the time. And on a street block of perhaps 50 to 80 of these houses, there were up to 7 Roman Catholic churches clearly indicated on the map that I consulted at the time.
Okay.
Now, and every street block had some Roman Catholic churches. And in most cases, the vicars or the priests of the local Catholic churches were the people that were instigating and enticing these school children to run amok.
Uh-huh.
So there was a definite agenda that was being driven from the Roman Catholic churches at the time. And, of course, Archbishop Dennis Hurley was a very prominent figure at that time to instigate and entice this anti, what he termed to be anti-apartheid government protest. But they were not protests. They were, in fact, acts of urban terrorism.
Sure.
Because there's a difference between protest and announcing your protest against what you didn't like. But the way in which these people did it was they were throwing Molotov cocktail petrol bombs at
It's called democracy.
Throwing them at houses.
Yeah, it's democracy. But
also at that time, Nelson Mandela was still in jail at that time, most probably busy getting educated into the ways and means of Freemasonry, because while he was in jail, he became a Freemason, and so did all the top structure individuals of the ANC and Communist Party at the time. They became Freemasons. Now, during this time also, Nelson Mandela orchestrated the planting of bombs on farm roads, in farm gates where people had to, for example, get out and open a farm gate. The planting of bombs in shopping centers, which were mostly used by white people at the time.
Yes.
Planting bombs on motor cars that are parked in city streets. In fact, people that at that time I was still a member of a Judeo-Christian church, and people in our assembly had, I lived in, as I said, in Johannesburg, and people in our assembly had gone on holiday to Durban, and they were driving a microbus, and the husband stopped in front of a radio shop called Govan Marnie, radio shop in Grey Street in Durban. And while his wife and children were sitting in the vehicle, which was packed with their camping material or their holiday,
yes,
you know, their suitcases and whatever they needed for the holiday, the wife and the children were in the car while the husband quickly ran into the shop. And while they were sitting there, the lady saw in the rear view mirror, which was on her left-hand side, the in South Africa, of course, the driver's side is the right-hand side. While she was sitting, talking to the children, she viewed in the rear view mirror a black man walking by, stopping and putting something on top of the left-hand side rear wheel of the vehicle.
Okay.
And she got unnerved, and she gathered the children, she climbed out of the vehicle, she locked the vehicle, and she went inside to the shop to look for her husband.
Uh-huh.
And while she was still busy walking towards him, they just heard this loud bang, and everything was shattered. Shop windows were shattered, and it was a bomb that had been planted on their vehicle's wheel.
Yeah.
So you can see it's very selective. These terrorists aimed in particular against white people. They aimed at particular, they aimed the atrocities and the methods of
terrorism.
Killing.
Yeah, terrorism is what it
methods
is.
Methods of terror.
Yeah.
In particular at farmers, because the way in which they had, for example, planted bombs bombs on farm roads, knowing that the farm roads, of course, are two strips of trodden,
yeah,
sand or dirt, and the way in which they planted these bombs were in particular, for example, when these farmers would come back from church, drive home, and on their way back home, they would go over this bomb and it would shatter the car and devastate the car and, of course, kill the inhabitants.
Right.
So it was always aimed against whites. It was
right.
Always aimed against the Boer in particular.
Right.
Now, Peter Mokaba was like the Julius Malema of today. Julius Malema, of course, is protected by the AfriForum, the Afrikaner organization AfriForum, who made an agreement with him, and they called it a agreement that was made in terms of cooperation, a mutual understanding, good neighborliness. There are these Afrikaner organizations that quietly, And it is definitely on the quiet because they try and keep it secretly. And then for example, gather a lot of money from the public, the white public, because they say that they want to take Julius Malema to court and bring him to justice.
Yeah.
But when the judge, when he's clearly ready to judge in AfriForum's favor in terms of getting this man to justice, bringing this man to justice, then they ask the judge that they would want to discuss this matter with Julius Malema and the ANC. And then they go into discussion, they come back and they ask the judge to actually rule against an earlier ruling by the Human Rights Commission that the singing of that song, Killer Farmer, Killer Boer, is hate speech. So the Afrikaner organization then turns it around that it is no longer hate speech. The blacks can sing it without fear of conviction, without fear of being taken to court in terms of judgment against them. So it is a difficult situation we're sitting with in South Africa. And in fact, I have taken on AfriForum on so many occasions. I've actually tagged, I don't know if you realize or if you know how to tag somebody on a particular posting. I've tagged the individuals within AfriForum. All they do is they just block me. Yeah. They don't even wish to defend themselves because they know they've got the financial means. They're getting millions of South African rands on a monthly basis from so-called the people that they represent in the workplace. But the moment that you're in the workplace and you need the support of the AfriForum organization, they have dropped so many people into this belief that they are there for them. But when it comes to the test, and I've got people from all over the country sending me information as to the cases that they have been battling with AfriForum. And it seems as if this organization is more there for the sake of blemishing whatever I as an individual wish to do to protect the Boers.
Right.
This organization goes against that. They're against the Boer. In fact, I've already asked in the open, what would it have been? What would their actions have been had the words of that song been "Kill a farmer, kill the Afrikaner"?
Right.
But they don't answer that question at all.
Right,
they.
Right.
But coming back, Pastor.
Yeah. Well, they're a shill organization. They're not pro Afrikaner. They're not pro white. They're not pro Boer. They're working for the enemy. This is a gigantic pretense.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But of course, the Afrikaners are keeping them in power in their particular realm of power because Afrikaners still believe that this organization is there for their goodwill. But they have deceived their own people on so many occasions that even Afrikaners have written to me and said to me, Dave, what can we do? This is the situation. Particularly, even their own members, even the members of their own organization in positions of power within the organization. For example, there was uproar or also these terrorists going into their mode of burning and breaking down and even brandishing knives and weapons. And the AfriForum chairman of that particular area, the branch of AfriForum, that particular area, he used the K word when he called the officers, the officers or the head office of AfriForum. He called the head office of AfriForum and said to them, what do I do, these? And he used the K word, have become uncontrollable in that area where he lived. And he was actually absconded, or he was kicked out of his position.
Uh-huh.
But more than that, they actually had thugs. They organized thugs to actually attack him. When he came out of work, he was attacked. He was thrown to the ground. He virtually had arms and legs broken, and he had ribs broken. He was in hospital. He was hospitalized for for some time. And when he wanted to open a case against them, it happened again, or he was being warned. He had to shut up because he could not go against AfriForum.
Right.
He was in their inner circles. Now, some of AfriForum's people or ex-people that used to be in their, how can I say, in their employ or rather in their positions of power on a local basis have contacted me and said to me, Dave, you won't believe how these people waste. People get asked, or the whites get asked to donate money for or towards the upliftment of whites that have been relegated to squatter camps.
Right.
You can't call it anything else because it is shacks that have been built up from waste material. So that is where many of the Boers, perhaps 750 to 800,000 of the Boers in South Africa, have been relegated to squatter camps because of the draconian and communistic abuse of power by the present government in terms of employment. It virtually becomes illegal to employ a white man in any position of management.
Mm-hmm.
If depending on the type, well, it virtually becomes impossible. Now, in this particular drive, AfriForum pretends or they purport to be on the workman's side. Yet, I have yet to see somebody's position that they have been able to protect, because it seems like they're merely using this as a means to gain power in particular, financial power. Because people subscribed and it costs quite a bit of money to subscribe to their so-called services. But when you need them, when you've run into problems and you need them, it becomes like an ordeal. I've just had this part. In fact, I think it was on Thursday, a lady called me from Johannesburg. She said to me, "Dave, what can I do? I've been in a battle with AfriForum for 12 years. I haven't been able to obtain a bit of joy from them. What can I do?" And I said to her, "Send me your information." A man calls me from Nelspruit, which is in the... Well, we were, if you can recall, when we were in Blood River, I called my brother, if you can recall, and he was in Nelspruit at the time, which is very close to the Kruger National Park. But man calls me from Nelspruit and he says to me, "Dave, I've been sitting for 8 years with a problem." A man calls me from Sasselburg. He says to me, "David, I've been sitting with for 4 years. Solidarity and AfriForum cannot help me. They're taking my money for services that they cannot provide."
Uh-huh.
So these organizations have become parasites and thriving on the subscriptions that they get from white people, but AfriForum in particular use that money to go and represent and fight a case for black people that have broken down the barriers that border the national road between Pretoria and the north. And they have broken down, and the local government have taken people, to individuals, to court because of the way in which they have vandalized the protection, to protect themselves against, first of all, attacks from the road, and also the dangerous thing of children running across the roads, which, of course, a national road, and it's a freeway, it's a highway.
Uh-huh.
So the local government takes these people to court. Guess what? AfriForum takes that money gathered, where they asked, this money will be used for white people to be uplifted, for the white children in squatter camps to be able to have shoes, to be able to go to school.
Right.
Or even suitcases, briefcases or their bookcases. Then they end up giving those bookcases to black children. I find it difficult to find words to describe the deception that these Afrikaners go through. It is as if they have abandoned all reasoning, and I have actually addressed the individuals in the highest position in these places. And
are they Jews? Are they Jews or Freemasons?
Well, they Edomites. They emanated from the Edomites that came as the Cape Dutch, and they've been thriving on whatever they can. You know, and I know that they are parasites, and they can parasite on anything that grows.
Yeah, right.
And even they even parasite on whatever is decaying. And the Boers are in a state of decadence because of these parasites, Pastor. And they,
yes,
the Boers are decaying at a rapid rate. And I can see, well, I can see two things. One is that there's a revival amongst the Boers in terms of their spirit, their spirituality, or no, I don't want to call it spirituality, but their spiritual state. The Boers are busy turning back to Father Yahweh. They have rediscovered his name. I see it daily. If I put out a, for example, a Shabbat Shalom or a blessed Sabbath to all my kinsmen, the way in which these people respond is absolutely fantastic. I haven't experienced this ever in my life, that there is such a revival and so many people turning back to Father Yahweh as I'm experiencing now. And I have experienced times of revival in the church, yes, when there was a spiritual awakening and people start praying every night through the night for the whole week or for 2 weeks nonstop. I've seen it,
yes,
in the 60s, and it happened in the 70s. But the churches have been praying for a revival, and it's, guess what? It's not happening in the church. It's happening amongst the Boers, because Father Yahweh is busy awakening his people. But they are being pressed. They are being marginalized. They are being disenfranchised. And the way in which this has been done has been coming for the past 100 years, Pastor. The Afrikaners did it to the Boers. They were marginalized. They were disenfranchised. They were they were relegated to the outer fringes of the economy over the past 100 years, or the previous 80 years by the Afrikaner, and the past 24 years by the ANC communists, and etc. So it's a sad state of affairs, Pastor. There's if you haven't seen the conditions yet in white squatter camps. They don't like us talking about white squatter camps, Pastor.
Or white farm camps.
So they would prefer us talking about refugee camps or refugee shelters.
Yes.
But it's still a squatter camp, irrespective of how you look at it. Because that is what they have been relegated to. That is what they have been marginalized to. Because if you cannot find work, how do you survive?
Yes.
And the pension funds, many of these people have been building their pensions for many years, only to find that the pension funds have become bankrupt because the government had taken out a loan with this pension fund and couldn't repay it. but they have money to squander in so many other areas of life.
Right.
You know, there's money for example, agents. There is money for... They even have a departmental Kentucky Fried Chicken account, 3.6 million rand in 1 month, just for Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yeah, it's not even Kentucky.
Yeah, and
amazing.
I think Cyril Ramaphosa, the present appointed president of South Africa, I have an opinion. And I state it's an opinion at this stage. I cannot recall. It might either be Cyril Ramaphosa that has the franchise for KFC in South Africa, or it is Tokyo Sekwale, which of course is also a black businessman. But Cyril Ramaphosa is over and over a billionaire. He's basically like a Donald Trump of South Africa.
Okay.
In terms of his financial position. And within within the first week or two that he was appointed as the president of South Africa, he had already started allocating contracts to some of his family members.
Yes, okay. Yes. Keeping it in the family.
Keeping it in the family.
But no fried chicken for poor whites.
No fried chicken for poor. In fact, I think so many of the whites have been put off Kentucky Fried Chicken altogether because at one stage, I think it was about 6-7 months ago, somebody had taken video image of a Kentucky Fried Chicken
shop or restaurant.
Well, the people in the shop spitting on and even urinating in the product
food.
Sold. And one particular female, a black female that worked in, or that I believe she still works for the KFC, she even said she hoped that the white patrons that frequented the shop where she lived, the KFC shop, like the
flavor?
menstrual fluids that she had deposited on the food that was sold.
Okay.
So,
yeah, this is how little respect blacks have for whites, even though they wouldn't even have a language. I mean, they had a language of maybe 300 or 400 words, no written language at all. And then they blame whites, you know, for stealing from them. No, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, also from 1994, on March 28th, Mandela himself ordered the killing of 19 rather Zulu protesters at Shell House, and all 11 ANC shooters were acquitted. Now, again, none of this made international headlines. Where, you know, this is terrorism by Mandela himself, who has been canonized by the world press as a saint. He can do no wrong. So why would Mandela order the killing of 19 Zulus?
Well, Nelson Mandela was, I think I have mentioned it before, he had some Jewish German blood in his ancestral lines. Apparently a German by the name of Mandel.
Oh.
And that had become Mandela.
Okay.
And on his mother's side, or rather he grew up in what is commonly known as Transkei in South Africa. The Transkei is on the eastern borders of the of the Cape, and so he is a Xhosa, and I know you won't be able to pronounce that, but a Xhosa is those people that were actually driven beyond the areas which the Zulus used, and it is a known thing that the more difficult a black tribe is, the more that they are driven from the other tribes. So that Xhosas were driven southward out of the way of the Zulus. Now, there was a lot of enmity between the Xhosas and the Zulus for many years, and in fact, with the white men coming to South Africa, the white man became the like of a buffer. They buffered between the Xhosas and the Zulus to prevent the Xhosas from attacking the Zulus and the Zulus from attacking the Xhosas, because they would have actually eradicated, either the one would have eradicated the other, or vice versa.
Yes.
But the white man was the peacemaker all along. And in those days, when of course the Boers had gone into those regions where that was uninhabited, which is what is currently, or that had been, the Boer Republic of Transvaal and the Boer Republic of the Orange Free State. Now, they became like the peacemakers between these tribes, which was a big mistake. Also, the way in which the Boers obtained great tracts of land was by, for example, when the Mosilikatsi group, which was in the northern parts of Transvaal, they stole cattle from the Zulus, and the voortrekkers or the Boers went and regathered the cattle for the Zulus and took the cattle back to the Zulus, and they traded that duty or that service that they had done for tracts of land. So the land that the Boers received or the land that the Boers occupied were either totally uninhabited, and these were large tracts of land like the northwest, the deep northwest of the Texas Badlands or the Dakota Badlands, which was totally uninhabited. I mean, right. There were no Indians in those areas at the time. Similarly, in South Africa or Southern Africa, there were large tracts of land where nobody was seen for weeks.
Yes.
It was totally uninhabited. And that was where the Boers established themselves, and where they needed to, for example, have access to the sea to establish, for example, a harbor, where they had foreseen to establish a harbor. They actually negotiated tracts of land for that purpose. And this was one of the things that was a problem to the British. And that is why the British established, for example, Swaziland, which was a protectorate, Lesotho, which was a protectorate, and also Botswana, which was a protectorate. So the British established these protectorates to basically ensure that the Boer republics did not have or could not have access to the sea.
Fascinating.
There was a very strategic move in this, but the Boers managed to negotiate the tracts of lands that would give them access to what is currently Richards Bay, a very prominent harbor in northern Natal.
Okay.
But the important thing to emphasize at this point is that the Boers, whatever they needed that they could not establish because of the fact that it was in use, it was not land that was inhabited, but it was frequently used by Zulus for the purpose of herding their cattle, for especially during winter, for their cattle to have an area where they could graze.
Okay.
But they didn't live there.
Right.
So these tracts of land was then negotiated in terms of the fetching or the returning of the cattle of the Zulus that had been stolen by the Silkats, the Mosilikats group. But something else that I wanted to say about Nelson Mandela, of course, before he was released from prison and before the unbanning of the ANC, the big liar, deceiver, deceptor at the time was F.W. de Klerk, who was then the National Party president of South Africa. Of course, the elected president by the Afrikaners. So the politics of the Afrikaner ran very close with their religion or their Judeo-Christian reformist churches. The churches were promoting F.W. de Klerk and Pik Botha and Chris Yunus and all the members of parliament or the members of the National Party of the day, in spite of the fact that a number of them were Satanists, these members of parliament, a number of them were Satanists, a number of them were, they were either members of the Freemasonry fraternity, or they were members, or rather they were all or and members of the Afrikaner Broederbond, which is like an Afrikaner Freemasonry organization. Now, this Afrikaner Broederbond was also an organization that sat squarely behind the orchestration or the orchestrating of the and the enticement of the British government to annex the Boer republics, in spite of international conventions that had been established, in spite of the fact that the British had been the signatories to those international conventions, like the 1878 Convention of Geneva, where no countries could annex additional land on the basis of war. And in spite of that, the British still came and it's just past my mind now, the English word for beset. They actually, if I can just get Bernice to help me on this one, it's not an annexation. The British came in because of the enticement or the incitement of the Cape Dutch, and in particular the role players too. That was the Afrikaner Broederbond that enticed the then Western world, the known world, the world of influence at the time, enticed the world to with propaganda. They used negative propaganda to ensure that the Boers did not or could not find sympathy with the rest of the world at the time when the British came can I call it beset? They beset the Boer republics. And without the firing of a single shot. Now, this was done, of course, by the Cape Dutch, whom they conspired with the likes of Cecil John Rhodes, whom we have already spoken about a lot.
Yes.
We had discussions, we had, I think, two discussions about the Jameson raid, how Cecil John Rhodes had actually equipped his people from his business organizations in Rhodesia and Botswana with British uniforms to make the Boers believe that it is the British that are attacking them. But in the meantime, it was a proxy military force led by and orchestrated by certain Stephanus Johannes Hofmeyer, and of course Cecil John Rhodes, and the Boers were in fact more clever than these individuals thought, and the Boers came to know the fact that it was not the British that were in fact attacking them, and they got a hold of this Stephanus Johannes Hofmeyer, whom was one of the key persons behind this Jameson raid. And but then they, when like, I mean, even to the point they orchestrated a number of civilians to become or to look like British soldiers. When that didn't work, of course they got onto the ship and they went across to England and they started conspiring with Lord Rothschild from the Illuminati faith.
Right.
Of course, he was the British, the owner of the Bank of England, and Lord Rothschild started closing the financial taps on the British government, forcing the British government to now go and beset the Boer republics, in spite of the 1853 Sand River Convention, in spite of the 1855-56 Bloemfontein Conventions. In spite of all of that, the British still came because they were forced by the conspiracy between the Cape Dutch Afrikaners and the international
Jews, Rothschilds.
The Rothschilds. and the Illuminati.
Yes.
And of course, with the likes of Jan Smuts and Louis Botha, who were Afrikaner Cape Dutch, who gave themselves, who came and offered their services to the Boer republics, as in the case of Jan Smuts, he was recommended by a Jew to the president of the then Boer Republic of Transvaal, President Paul Kruger, whom we've spoken about quite a bit already.
Yes.
But Sammy Marx, a Freemason, had actually recommended Jan Smuts to become a minister of justice. And of course, Jan Smuts being part of the conspiracy and a major proponent of the Anglo-Boer War, of course, he was in the position that he wrote the declaration of war against Britain. It must be remembered that the Boers declared war against Britain by the enticement of Jan Smuts.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And of course, Jan Smuts, being a Freemason, he was always protected. He had the English even had very clear instructions not to fire any weapons at him because he was
on their side.
He was basically on their side.
Yeah.
There was not one particular event or not one particular military event where his life was in danger because he was being protected at all times by both sides.
Yes.
And of course, he was spared for the purpose of the big deception of the 1908 so-called Union talks, the talks of the unification of South Africa with the four provinces, the Boer Republics of Transvaal and the Free State, and then, of course, the British colonies of Natal and the Cape. And Jan Smuts played a major role in the... In fact, I believe he also dictated the words of the peace agreement, the peace that was settled between the British and the Boers in terms of the stopping of the war on the 31st of May 1902. And Jan Smuts became a very prominent person in the British history as well. He was made a field marshal in British military. He received honors of glory, medals, etc.,
uh-huh,
for his massive role in the Anglo-Boer War and then also in the First World War. But he was a traitor through and through. In fact, he was a Trojan horse that had emanated.
Yeah, like Judah P. Benjamin, the South Rothschild agent during the Civil War.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, in 1994... The new constitution, I'm quoting it here directly, the state may not unfairly discriminate directly or indirectly against anyone on any grounds, including race, gender, sex, pregnancy, marital status, etc. So it specifically states that the state may not discriminate against anyone on the basis of race. Now, it's really obvious that the black government of South Africa has not lived up to this promise of its own law.
Pastor, one can question for the first quite a number of years of the so-called democracy, one can question whether the ANC was in control or were they merely puppets of the established orders of the Freemasons.
Okay.
Because you must remember that one of the conditions that, or let's say this, that which was publicized by the government of the day, in those days, of course, mostly being either Freemasons or Afrikaner Broederbonders, they stated without any fear of contradiction from my side, they stated it clearly that Nelson Mandela had already waived his methods of sabotage, he's waived his terrorism, etc., that he has become a man of peace, which was when Nelson Mandela walked out of the prison where he was held. When he walked out of prison, he threw his fist into the air and he shouted, Amandla. Now, Amandla stands as a shortened form. I'm not sure exactly what it stands for, but basically when he enticed people to kill whites, it was also called Amandla, and he then would sing Kill a Farmer, Kill a Boer, or Kill the White Man.
Yes.
So it was very evident that F.W. de Klerk and Pik Botha and the likes of all the other Freemasons that so desperately wanted the whites to believe that we are now entering a time of peace, that they had lied, that they had deceived the people, because the moment that Nelson Mandela walked out of jail, he still shouted Amandla with his fist in the air. And if one looks at the atrocities that he had committed while he was in jail, and even months before he came out of prison, he still orchestrated the planting of bombs and the killing of, well, everybody knows that Winnie Mandela was the queen of necklaces.
Yeah.
And where the necklaces were motor car tires that had been filled with petrol and hung around the necks of those blacks that they felt were traitors to their objectives. And she still executed this. There are many blacks that insisted that way beyond 1994, she was still an executive of many of these so-called suburban killings of their own people, when they don't heed to the instructions that they are given, if they don't abide by the rules that were being dictated to them, that had been established during their so-called freedom fight, or their fight for freedom, they would be necklaced.
Yes.
And I mean, this kind of thing still happens today.
Yes.
Where the people are being necklaced if they don't abide by those instructions and rules that had been established in those times.
Yes.
And I mean, after 24 years, it's 24 years now since the so-called democratization of South Africa. And just in this past week, Pastor, you mentioned about in terms of race and language and etc., discrimination.
Yes.
But the very first laws that were drafted, now you must remember, after the ANC took over power from the National Party, or the Freemasons within the National Party, they continued on what was an interim constitution, etc., and when that constitution, which was so-called established and set in motion, there was going to be no discrimination. But that was when actual discrimination started against the white man, because they deemed it to be a time of restitution. They deemed it to be a time of restoration and to the normalization. But that actually set the whole thing of total discrimination against the white man. Now, I must remember something that I must say at this point. The Boer had been the object of discrimination since 1902, the 31st of May 1902, when they signed the peace declaration, the Boers had been relegated as and subjugated to the Afrikaners, and they've been subjugated and relegated to third-class citizens, even in their own home provinces or their home states, you know, Boer Republics of Transvaal and Free State. And so many Afrikaners have risen out as so-called super Afrikaners, but nowhere there's a super Boer. The Boers have been slowly but surely, they have been eradicated, they have been eliminated, they have been disowned. Thousands of them were, of the Boers were disowned from their farms after the establishment of the Union government way back in 1910 under Jan Smuts and Louis Botha. Now, with those disowning, with those farmers being disowned, both outside and inside the Boer republics, those farms had been given to those Cape Dutch Afrikaners that were fighting against the Boers, that had been successful in being Trojan horses, being going into and amongst the Boers and staying with the Boers for 2-3 weeks at a time. And then to gather as much information as to where these Boers farms are, where, what's the names of their wives, what's the names of their children, what's the names of their pets, only to go and then gather those wives and children and herd them to the concentration camps. Many of the concentration camps were under the control and the under the command of Afrikaner, Cape Dutch Afrikaner commanders. In British uniforms. And, of course, many of these Boer women were even raped by these people.
Yes.
And then they get rewarded by getting that Boer's, or that the farm that where that Boer was being disowned from as a gift. Jan Smuts gave it to them as gift for their part in the subjugation of the Boers to the Afrikaner.
Yes.
And to this day, the Boers have been subjugated. Pastor, I've been, I don't know, we have discussed very little about the so-called Boeremag trial, the Boeremag event in South Africa, where just to do the atrocities, and I can only call it an atrocity, the way in which this court case was dealt with, where false witnesses were even paid to bear false witness against these people. And I've been very close to some of these people in jail, and I don't want to mention their names for fear of
get in trouble. But
the sad thing is, these people were lured into these and they were enticed into what they were believed to be the protection of what they deemed to be, well, they were from the Republic of Transvaal. They were Boers from the Republic of Transvaal. The Republic of Transvaal had never been, the constitution had never been revoked. It was an illegal act of the Union of South Africa and throwing the Boer republics. It was unconstitutional to the Republic of the Boers, Boer Republic of Transvaal. It was unconstitutional to the Boer Republic of the Orange Free State. Those constitutions of those republics are still in place today. And yet the
all right, sorry, well, Pastor. we're just about out of time, so. We'll have to pick this up next week. I'll be in touch with you about next week, okay? And so in the meantime, thanks for this update on how the beautiful multiracial state of South Africa is working so wonderfully, just like they promised, right? Folks, we've been lied to by the international Jew and by the international communists. And they're not through with us yet, so we better start fighting back. All right, Pastor Martin, thank you for your input. Folks,
thank you, Pastor.
Okay, folks, that's it for today's show. Take care. Yahweh bless everybody. Bye-bye.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.